Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
And
I'm Sam Farrell.
Sam Farrell!
Welcome to the show.
Sam, I'm so glad you're joining us. I gave you about 45 minutes notice that you're going to be on the podcast.
And some lovely Chinese food.
We just got back from Mission Chinese.
Oh, man.
Sam and I know each other because we've lost a lot of Emmys together.
Oh,
Sam is executive producer of the Antiques Roadshow, and we met at the Creative Arts Emmys.
That's a Battlefield promotion. I'm actually senior producer. I just want to make sure everybody understands that, but that's okay.
Okay. So we met the first year that I lost. I think it was your... You've lost way more Emmys than I have.
We're coming up for number 17.
And 17! That's wow. Susan Lucci territory.
It is. She lost at 19, I believe. Won the first one at 19. And with the 17th coming up, I was looking at an article the other day that showed us who is likely to win and who is who should
deserves
win.
To win.
And that deserves to win, that put us in third place. And who is likely to win, they put us at sixth place. So... I'm not doing anything except crossing my fingers.
Just to bellyache a little bit about the Television Academy. When you look at the list of nominees in our category, which is scripted reality.
We are in structured reality, yes.
Right.
Unstructured reality is Real Housewives of New York or something?
I think you're correct about that. Structured is like someone did get around to writing a script that we kind of follow. But also in this category are things like Shark Tank, Intervention,
The Boss, that
Undercover Boss, yeah. My
Diners,
Life on the D-List.
Drive-ins and dives. Yeah.
Basically, it's like five different genres of television in one category.
Yeah.
Because while reality is half of television, it is literally like three categories of the Emmys.
Well, there's also informational. So there's reality competition, there's structured reality.
Right.
Unstructured reality. And there's also informational, which, you know.
It's like documentaries?
Yeah.
It's actually informational is like Nova.
No, it's not. So last year it was Morgan Freeman. I'm trying to remember the title, but
one of the Penguin films or something like
that. It was a documentary style, but it's not the document. News and Docs is on in New York in June, I believe. So,
so you're saying that everything. That because Diners and Drives and Dives and is so every
triple
type of,
D norm
right every food channel or travel channel type show where they have someone going around introducing you to places or that's fits in this category.
Man versus Food. I'm sure
Bourdain was in your category, right?
Right. No, he was in informational.
Oh, he was in informational. Oh,
that is a weird line.
Bourdain.
Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, it's very strange, and the Academy's way behind in sort of embracing reality television. There are literally more categories for camera work than there are for reality type shows.
Wow.
And more categories of reality than there is.
I mean, it just sounds like the phrase reality as a category, as a bucket, is just describes a way a show is produced, a way a team gets together to
Well, it's literally the opposite of fiction, right? So we're non-fiction.
Right.
There
are so many different varieties.
And there used to be a non-fiction category, which was where Nova was. And Catherine Nelson, who was the director of Discovery's PR when I started, and is one of my closest friends now, she's the one that got MythBusters out of the category with Nova and like the Kennedy Center Honors and those things into reality, where we had a fighting chance, and that's actually why Deadliest Catch eventually won because they were moved into that category. Yeah.
Yes, they were moved into that category, but they also bounced around all
they
over
did.
The place.
Yeah. Yeah.
I should give a plug for WGBH here because Nova is also produced by WGBH, and it's a great pleasure to work for. The flagship public television station.
I grew up watching WGBH. I even knew, as Sam was surprised, that it stands for Great Blue Hill.
I wasn't surprised at all.
Oh, good.
I was surprised that you knew it.
No, that's what I mean. That was my... I grew up watching Monty Python with my parents and Julia Child. And
a lot of good radio shows out there, too.
We have a radio station. In fact, we have... a classical radio station and a news station, and we now serve most of New England with, in some way or other, either in partnerships or directly.
That's great.
Very cool.
It's fantastic.
And is Antiques Roadshow shooting nearby? Is that why you're here, or are you here on just a family vacation?
This is a family vacation, but actually we were here in May.
You were. I was out of town for some reason.
Yeah, and we shot in Sacramento at the Crocker Art Museum, and we made some pretty good TV there. It was exciting. Sacramento is a sweet city. It's one of the things I've discovered about being on Antiques Roadshow is these smaller cities, and I hope Sacramento doesn't mind me calling it that. But
no,
Sacramento.
Tomato.
You were talking about Cleveland earlier, Fort Worth. These second cities are where all the energy is. It's great, you know. Obviously, the big cities, they've got their reputations, everybody knows about them, but they're kind of jaded. They know what they are. These smaller cities are fun to visit.
Is it part of how you decide the where you go in a season? Or?
Well, we like to spread ourselves across the country as much as possible. And so, you know, if we've been somewhere, we have a rule that we'll never return to that city in less than 5 years.
Oh.
The stuff doesn't come in very different each time, and you know, we know the people and so on and so forth, and if you go back too often, it loses its edge.
So I know that you must field all sorts of superlative questions, like what's the weirdest thing that, but what I'm curious about is, are there objects or categories of objects that are weirdly regional?
Well, actually, I hate to be contrary, and my son is listening to us do this, and he's the king of contrary, and he always says, well, guess where I learned that from, Dad? Objects, as we like to say, have legs. So we were in Hawaii and found a fabulous piece of Boston furniture.
Wow.
We were in Boston and found a beautiful Koa Hawaiian bowl. Stuff is everywhere.
It's true.
And,
okay.
And in the most surprising places, you find the most wonderful things. The thing that you'll love, and this is not a scoop or anything, but we haven't broadcast yet. The thing that you'll love is a guy came in who used to work I think it was with Doug Trumbull, but... he had, was it George Lucas? Anyway, you'll be able to tell me this. I'm having
on the East Coast. It was probably Trumbull.
This was in Sacramento.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
I'm having a brain block here. But anyway, he brought in the dummy for the Ark of the Covenant.
What?
Yeah, and his father had worked on the Death Star, and done all sorts of bits and pieces. He brought dozens and dozens of pieces
in Sacramento.
In Sacramento, oh, I have a photo of it. I will show you.
Oh
later.
My God! Please do.
So here we are in Sacramento. You have no right to believe it's going to show up in Sacramento or anywhere else.
Yeah.
And this thing shows up, and it looks a bit like a sort of... And you're a class A sculptor and model maker. And the person who put this together had put some care in it. But since it was going to be burnt as the prototype to see how we're going to make this shot work and how we're going to do this, you know, it had no back. It was black on the inside, and it had some sort of little ornament to it. But it doesn't really look exactly like the actual Ark in the movie.
Wow. But it was like a camera test version.
Camera test version, yes.
Wow.
And that was
amazing.
Of fun.
That's so cool.
And every object has those stories, right? Like when we hear about all the time in the pop culture world, where, you know, the Death Star model was found in like a piano shop, and some garbage can here, and some person saved it because it was going to be destroyed, and that's so fun.
I mean, that happens a lot. That's a great story. This guy, it was his dad's, and his dad had collected these pieces as he had been a model maker and so on and so forth, and he brought them with him. And my decision, which was one of the hardest decisions, you have all these pieces of the Death Star that have, you know, some of which probably had been featured in the film and were worth a lot of money. And I said, but everybody's seen Star Wars. Everybody knows it so well. The Ark is, you know, everybody's seen that too, but they haven't, you know, it's not something you think of immediately when you think of when you think of movies and so on. So it seemed to me like it was the best thing to pull out of this. And it ended up being worth, I think, $80,000.
Wow.
And this is not even something that appeared on camera.
Yeah, no, that doesn't sound unreasonable. Given props from Raiders command a really high price on the prop market. And something like that, if it had an unbroken provenance, then absolutely it would be an amazing piece to have collected.
One of the things that always amazes me about Roadshow is that you all always have, like, the breadth of knowledge of the experts that you have evaluating pieces is just astounding. Like, Do you bring different? I mean, since you can get anything anywhere, I guess you have to bring just a general group of folks everywhere you go.
Murderers Row. Right, Murderers Row. That's a brilliant expression. We should keep that. We have a pool of about 150 current appraisers. And I won't say they're the only experts in the country. There are certainly other people. And they have to be involved in the market because we're talking about price. So they aren't museum experts. They aren't academics, most of them, although a lot of them are academically trained. The one thing that they seem to have in common a lot is that they're steeped in it, what they deal with in their families. It just comes down generation to generation. Half the time, these are people with, you know, grandparents who are in the business and so on and so forth. But it's one of the most enjoyable parts of my job is when we sit down at the beginning of the year trying to, you know, we've asked everybody when can they come, and we sit down at the beginning of the year and we have to figure out how do we get 70 appraisers in each location and cover
70?
70.
Well, that explains a lot.
Right. And then we cover the whole, you know, gamut from, you know, folk art, books, furniture, musical instruments, posters,
movie
paintings,
props.
Movie yeah. props. And so there's that sort of puzzle, putting that puzzle together is one of the most fun, other than the actual shoot day, that's one of the most fun days there is.
And then when it comes to the shoot day, what does the layout of the space look like? We get glimpses of that in the show.
You brought up something. I mean, my publicist will be just so happy. You know, we can talk now about how we've changed. I mean, we've changed to using. And we used to go to convention centers, and we'd set up a set that was roughly 100 feet across and just have everybody in a circle. And we'd have three shooting locations, and the cameras, because it was in a convention center, could just truck easily from one shooting location to another. We shoot here, the others are getting ready, the others are being taken down.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Couple of handhelds, and it worked really well. It was very efficient. And then we were asked to consider changing it up, and we are now going to what we call distinctive, historic, and iconic locations around the country, and we're shooting outside.
Oh,
and we're shooting museums, certainly, mansions.
Houses of note.
Houses of note. We went to a racetrack. We went to Churchill Downs, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
And if you ask me to remember all the cities we went to this year, I probably couldn't let it down like that.
Actually,
but
I'm just wondering if you have filmed at Mount Vernon.
We certainly are considering it at some point, but we haven't yet. It's exactly the sort of thing that would be a lot of fun to shoot at.
So I have a wish.
Okay.
And this goes out onto the podcast. In the front foyer of Mount Vernon is a small converted lantern in which hangs a key to the Bastille that was sent to Washington by his former aide-de-camp, the Marquis de Lafayette. And it came with a letter that said, you know, from a defender of liberty to the father of liberty, as a small offering. It was during the French Revolution, obviously. Anyway, you're not allowed to take pictures at Mount Vernon. And so there are very few good high-res photographs of this. And it's a piece I've been working on for years, making a replica of both the key and the box, the half-lantern that it's actually sitting in. So if you get to Mount Vernon, I have a wish list of photos for you.
If we ever get that.
And by the way, if anyone who works at Mount Vernon or lives there and wants to get me some of these photos,
Adam, you can just say this out loud. You don't have to wait until... Yeah.
But so to continue that thought about these locations, one of the things it offers is... this visual richness and a great background and a better understanding of the places we are. And it feels great and the crowd love it. And surprisingly, our appraisers mostly like it, although some are not fans of having to sit outside in the sun or the rain, understandably. That is one of the great benefits of doing this. Now, you asked about the layout of it. So now we're, you know, we were at Winterthur, which is an old DuPont mansion. Huge place. It's now a center for decorative arts in America, and they do a lot of academic work and conservation in particular, and they have a museum, but it's laid out all over the place. So we have to we have a fabulous staff, and I won't mention any names because I will doubtless forget somebody, but they're also brilliant. They put together a layout. The crowd comes in here. We're going to have, you know, these tables here. We're going to shoot here. We're going to put our sponsor's truck. You know, we have a big 53-foot truck with all our stuff in it, which is wrapped with sponsor stuff on it. We have the feedback booth, which I'm sure you love. And we got to work out where all this goes, how it gets powered, how it gets serviced. And then we have to put up tents and so on and so forth.
Wow.
Every single place is now a completely different location.
That sounds so fun.
Used to be we'd say, here's our CAD
right.
of how you do it in a convention center. And the convention center has to have relatively column-free space that's got to be, you know, 80 by 200 or something
right.
like that.
Right.
100,000 feet is our ideal. And that's what we used to say. Those were our specs. And obviously there are many others too. But now it's like, you know, how are we going to make that work? Wow. And how do we fit that in here?
When you do a different one, it's all different every year now then too.
Each seat. So we went to five cities this year, and each location was very, very different.
What's the, I mean, so if I bring my thing to the show, what's the process? Do you have producers and kind of aiming people toward the appraisers that are going to be the right thing for the thing that they bring in?
Or? So this goes back to the idea of reality. Now, and I wouldn't want to say anything bad about any other reality show, but we're the best. So one of the things we pride ourselves on is that what you see on camera is the first time reaction, and the first time that guest ever hears that information.
Wonderful.
That's
so good.
And so we never do a retake on a reaction. We might do retakes and pickups and all the rest of it, just as any television show does, but the reaction is what you see, and we have to edit it down for time, but this is authentic. And so when a person comes into the show and they have, I don't know, we always say a vase or a sword or whatever mm-hmm. it is. They come in and they go to this front desk, which we call triage, which I always thought was...
That sounds perfect.
Well, you know, there's less blood and guts involved, you know. we have a lovely crowd of people and who are knowledgeable, but are also versed in, you know, customer service, and they know how the show works and so on. And they say, well, I'm going to give you a ticket to go to Militaria. And you take your sword over to Militaria, and you stand in line again. And the Militaria experts will be there. There'll usually be three of them, sometimes four. And, you know, the person will go up to the desk, and they'll have this sword. Now, going back to earlier about choosing our appraisers, you know, we have guys who know Revolutionary War, guys who know Civil War, guys who know 20th century. And so, you know, assuming this sword is, you know, just a standard sword, most of them will know everything about it. It gets a bit special. They'll say, hey, you know, Rafe, come over here and tell me what you know about this. Or, you know, Joel, is this from pre-revolutionary stuff? And then they'll give the appraisal and so on and so forth, and people will go on their merry way. But if they took a look at it, and they might give each other a glance, they'll say to the guest, excuse me, but we'd like to see if a producer would like to tape that.
Okay. Yeah.
Would you mind sitting down over there, and somebody will come and see you hopefully soon?
Okay.
And they wait, and a producer such as myself or my boss, Marsha, or Jill, will come along and we'll interview the guest and interview the appraiser and say to the appraiser, well, what makes this so special? You know, I've seen a million swords. You know, what's so great about this? And you interview the guest, and how did you get it and all the rest of it? And what do you know about it? And we find out information, and then we build a story in our minds. And we say, okay, all right, well, that's good. Or, you know, it was so nice of you to wait behind. The appraiser will now give you his appraisal. But if we want to record them, they off they go to the green room, which is... In the convention centers, it was always blue. but now the green room is, you know, the children's lunchroom at a museum or something like that. And they'll sit there, do some paperwork, and wait for us to come and get them to take them.
So everyone gets an appraisal if they get to the point of the first...
Everybody gets an appraisal.
And it's not necessarily the monetary value that gets them selected. It's...
Correct.
In the story, the interesting provenance.
There was a fabulous piece, which I happened to pick. And it gives you goosebumps because this is, especially this being shortly after the 100th anniversary of the First World War. It was a peach can label, and this American GI had, and you know, resources were scarce, so he'd peeled off the peach can label, and he decided to write to the company that made the can of peaches. And he wrote this letter. And at the end, he wrote, you know, these peaches are worth fighting for. And it sort of gives you goosebumps, right?
Right.
Oh, man.
And it was actually only worth $800 as an item, you know, that you could buy and put in your collection and so on and so forth. But it was a human story. And it wasn't even... So the guy had got it. I can't remember exactly how. It wasn't some hugely personal object to him. But it was hugely personal to all of us. And this is what I like to say about Antiques Roadshow, is it is the story of American identity. Everybody can identify with some aspect of each appraisal.
Right.
It's got to be so exciting when you realize you've got one of the good stories. It's
yes.
Like the moment that you live for. And you how many of them do you get a day? Like how often does that happen?
Well, we're recording somewhere around 60 or 70 items a day.
Wow. And that makes me so tired from a producing standpoint.
Yeah, with three teams shooting?
No, we have we now have four teams shooting and we have a B-roll set up and we have a digital team. And so there's six. And then we have the feedback booth as well. We'll catch a bit of stuff.
Before we continue with talk this week, I want to let you know that support for Still Entitled this week comes from Away. Away offers high quality luggage at a much lower price by cutting out the middleman and selling directly to you. You can choose from 9 colors and 4 different sizes, including 2 carry-on sizes, which are both compliant with all major U.S. airlines. All of their suitcases are made with premium polycarbonate, which is lightweight and unrivaled in strength and impact resistance. And I love the fact that they have 360-degree spinner wheels, which guarantees a smooth ride. Best of all, both of their carry-on sizes are able to charge anything that's powered by a USB cord with a built-in, very nicely designed battery pack. And thanks to their lifetime warranty, if anything breaks, Away will fix or replace it. You can try it for 100 days, and if at any point you decide it's not for you, return it for a full refund. No questions asked. I'm personally a big fan of carry-on luggage, and the bigger carry-on model from Away is perfect for me. It has really nice space inside, well-organized for my clothes and my gear, and for an upcoming week-long trip, that's the only suitcase I'm going to take because it's plenty of space. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/untitled and use the promo code untitled during checkout. That's awaytravel.com/untitled and use the promo code untitled for $20 off a suitcase. Now back to the conversation.
I'm really curious about the crazies. I am sure that you've had to deal with people who are desperate to get on the show and keep maybe gaming their arrival with objects they think will entice you.
Well, yeah, and we have
repeat appearances.
So I wouldn't want to suggest that anybody who comes to Roadshow is anything other than charming and wonderful.
I'm just saying, from a producing standpoint, there might be headaches caused by a certain kind of...
That's what you're talking about, Adam.
And so one of the things I've learned, and this is actually a lot of fun, is interviewing technique. And one day I was actually shadowed by somebody who was a trained, I want to say, CIA interviewer. I can't remember how she was attached to the show, but she came and shadowed me for a while, and we talked a bit about various techniques. And I had already developed a number of techniques. But one of the simplest things, I probably shouldn't give this away, people learn how to combat it, but it's very hard. People like to fill in the gaps.
Yeah, you just are quiet.
You stay quiet.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's unbelievable. And if you can't get people to confess if they're doing something wrong by filling in the gaps, you say, I'll be right back. I'm just going to go and talk to him. There are a number of times when I've gone to talk to an appraiser and say, I'm just letting him or her think about this a bit. I've asked them a question. I don't think they're telling me the full answer. And then I'll go back and they say, oh, well, yeah, I did have it appraised actually. Yeah. 2 years ago. And yeah, I know for this much. And so, well, it's nice. Thank you. And then, you know, maybe that doesn't ruin the appraisal, or maybe they've just told you enough that they're not going to show up as great guests on a TV reality show where the response is very valuable.
Well, so per your thing of being quiet, I interviewed Asif Manvi a couple years ago on stage, and he was talking about doing the Away shoots for The Daily Show, which was a format invented by Stephen Colbert. Mm-hmm. And so each time a new comedian producer would go off to do an Away shoot for the first time, Stephen would sit them down and tell them the two important rules about doing that. And one is everyone loses 15 IQ points when you point a camera at them. And the other one was shut up and let them bury themselves. You just be quiet as you can, and they will fill in the gaps. And then the last thing I remember, years ago, a friend of mine was owed money by a film company for writing a script, and they were like 10 months late in paying him. And his agent said, here's what you do. Call the guy whose number you have and say, I'm wondering where my check is. And then don't say another word in the phone call. until he said something substantive. And so my friend was like, oh, it's a violation of all the social norms. He was like, hey, Doug, I'm just wondering where my check is. And then there's this pause. It's like 10, 15 seconds long. And then Doug starts going, and then.
Because you can't hang up. Yeah. It's like a telemarketer thing.
Totally amazing how effective that is.
Yeah. So we get that. And we also have, I mean, I have to say everybody is almost 100% wonderful. And we
obviously, but I'm just wondering, is there someone whose picture you have on the wall of the van that says, don't let this guy in?
Funnily enough, the UK show, I think I can tell this story. The UK show has pictures of people because they like to have people in the background. We don't generally have people who are just standing watching the action. The UK show has pictures of people who make it a habit to come to the show and stand in the background, and they ask them to move out of the shot.
That's really funny.
But we occasionally get people. We have a fabulous security guy, Sean, who's a ex-New York narcotics detective.
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
And Sean takes care of us, and he likes to think it's his show. We let him think that. But he keeps us safe. And if there are really crazy people, and we've had one or two people who've had to be escorted out.
I have to imagine the Antiques Roadshow audience is less likely to require bouncing than, you know, your whatever more, you know, less PBS reality shows are, maybe.
Do you find that the breadth of things that people bring, not even the stuff that you show, is representative of, like, manufacturing in America throughout the 20th century? And has that changed over...
That's a thread, isn't it? I mean, so there are all these threads. There's you know, how people came here. So we see, you know, painted chests from Scandinavia. We see manufacturing. We see advertising. That's a huge thing. Cultural things. You know, we see...
But, like, as, you know, if it's typically of a certain age group who inherited from their parents, like, 20 years from now, is it still going to be the swords and the cabinets and the chests, or is it going to be... You know, the
Star Wars action
figures. Right. Yes, people are changing. And one of the sad things I think is sad, and I don't think it's sort of worth crying about, but I think it's slightly sad, is the death of the sort of dinner table experience. But that has meant a major change in how Americans communicate, and it has made a major change in the decorative arts. So, for instance, if you have a wonderful china set that was passed down from your grandmother, you probably won't be able to sell it, but if you do, it'll be worth almost nothing. On the other hand, if you want to buy a replacement piece, that'll cost you a lot of money. But it's that sort of thing, or what we call brown furniture, is no longer you know, sought after, because kids, a lot of people into their late 20s and 30s, are living with their parents. They don't have spare space to put furniture or even collect stuff. So there's a big shift in that. But that being said, people like interesting looking things. People like beauty. People like things that relate to their childhood and relate to the history and the culture. And there'll always be stuff that people want. The values may go up and down, but everything will always remain collectible.
So how many weeks a year are you guys in production, pre-production and production?
It's hard to tell because it sort of blends from one into the other, right? Yeah,
Well, how many episodes are in a season?
Well, all right, so there are, this year, 15 new episodes, 3 themed specials, and 6 of what we call vintage, where we have repacked shows from 15 years ago and updated the prices.
Oh, neat.
And that's a lot of fun to watch, and we play that game.
Yeah.
And as Marcia will tell people when she's giving presentations, we all try and guess. When we're in the screenings, you know, has it gone up or down? And we are not much better than 50%.
Wow.
Some of that stuff is posted online, too. Do you take into account, like, the things that might go viral? Because an internet audience has special attachment to it, or you think?
Well, so I happen to know that one of the things that went viral was a Rolex watch. And I think it had 5 million hits.
That's the one that
most
came
of them
with
in Germany.
All of its original paperwork that the guy bought at the PX.
In
I
Germany.
Watched that episode.
Right. Yeah. And so
it's
there are things.
A beautiful one.
Yeah. And that's one of the collectibles now. Who'd have thought it? The things that are going up in value. So Rolexes from the 60s and 70s, who'd have thought? But they're now worth, you know, ridiculous sums of money. In fact, we saw one. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
We saw one in Fargo. We were in Fargo. Talk about different locations. We were in Fargo, this reconstructed Old West town with buildings from different eras and you know, 1840s print shop and a telegraph shop and all this. Anyway, we were in Fargo and this guy came in. And you're going to want to watch the Fargo episodes. They're our first episodes. It tells you how exciting they are. I think they're our first. I may have made a mistake there. But anyway, this guy brings in a Rolex. It is phenomenal. And his reaction, I mean, he's completely floored. And when I say that, you will see when you watch it. It's a this thing is worth over $500,000. And it's just phenomenal.
Wow.
Are there cases in which you and your crew have become experts at things that are chronically under or overvalued on eBay?
That's an interesting point. The people come in expecting, well, I saw this on eBay and so on and so forth. And I like to say where we differentiate ourselves is it's all very well. You can categorize things. You can even catalog things. But it takes an expert to spot the really special things. And so they come in with this and they say, well, I know it's worth, you know, $10,000. You say, well, it would be if, you know, I mean, you're in the in the Star Wars collectibles. You know, if what is that? There's the Jawa with a.
The cloth cape, vinyl cape.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the difference, and we discovered that this year. So there are little bits and pieces, but that can be faked, and so an expert can say, "Well, I can tell the fake because it's got, it doesn't have the
shiny
signature
threads, the cloth or whatever."
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly, and so an expert can do that, and somebody on eBay usually can't. And where we are, you know, able to help people out is the eye, the human eye, this eye that is bred through hours and hours and hours, countless hours, sort of Malcolm Gladwell's, you know, 10,000 hours doesn't do it justice, you know, of seeing this stuff day in, day out, and you know what's right until somebody picks up a piece of supposedly Tiffany Favreel glass and says, no, it's wrong because it doesn't feel heavy enough.
Do experts reach out to you and try to be part of the show? And if what do you look for when adding to that group?
That's a good question. They do reach out. We have a lot of veterans. And I mean that as people who have been loyal to the show, not just been there for a long time. And it's hard to find a space for new people. But we're always looking. And we want to bring in people who are in areas that are exciting to young collectors and to help, you know, increase the breadth of the kind of audience that we can get and so on and so forth. But essentially what the main criterion, well, there were two or three, but is that they are well-respected experts in their field and that anybody I called in their field would say, yeah, I know him and I respect him.
Oh, Steve's okay.
Well, the fact that everyone comes and gets an appraisal is an amazing thing in and of itself, because I have a friend, an old friend who was an antiques dealer for a long time, and he used to very sourly like talk about people coming in and wanting free appraisals, number one, which is costly for an expert to do, and then saying free appraisals are actually most of the time worth what you paid for them. Which is to say, you know, it's like I remember telling him about some, you know, some news show in New York did a thing where they took an antique around to a bunch of antique stores and watched in hidden camera as it was chronically undervalued. Right, I'll buy this from you for X. And my friend was like, why would you get mad at that? That's literally America. Buy low, sell high. And we love stories about, I bought this at a garage sale for $5 and sold it for $150,000. Well, what about the guy who's when he was a kid? Shouldn't he get a chunk of that if you're getting all upset about this?
You're not allowed to get upset about it. You either get it one way or the other, but not both.
Well, and it all came back around as a way of me understanding how much love and time and effort goes into being an appraiser and giving your deep, heartfelt, real, educated opinion about what's going on with this thing in front of you. It's very much worth paying to have stuff appraised, and it's great that you guys provide that service.
Well, thank you. And we always like to say that we provide a verbal approximation of value and not an insurance appraisal. We're not giving somebody a written IRS appraisal. But we are lending the knowledge and expertise. And I think most of the people on the show agree that, you know, you can be short-sighted about this and say, I've got to charge for everything. God damn it, I'm not going to give up any of my expertise for somebody who wants it for free. But most of them are generous and helpful and and want you to know more, and hopefully, you know, maybe you'll become a customer of theirs, maybe you won't, but it helps the whole community.
I remember at one point the same friend whose one of his specialties was African art. He at dinner one time, he said, "Here, let me give you a test," and he handed me these two objects, and he was like, "One of these is fake and one of these is real. Tell me what you think." And it was very difficult, but I got it right, and it was because it was this ephemeral aspect of, like, the dirt here just feels somewhat contrived, whereas this thing just seems to have a lot deeper history. And he was like, you're getting to the soul of how difficult it is to appraise things.
Well, so this is one of the key things that I've learned is, and I'm sitting here in your shop with, it's almost like an antique store.
Yeah.
You know, I could look around here and say ooh and ah at a lot of things and recognize some of them. If I'm in an antique store, I would find it very hard to pick out one phenomenal piece. But mm-hmm. when I'm called to a table by our appraisers, and they're holding this, or the guest is holding this, I know there's something they've seen
right,
about
right,
it.
Right, something important.
So I can become immediately that much more clever than I would be in a store. And I'm looking at this thing saying, okay, and I can frequently guess, oh, it's, you know, this much, or it's a fake or whatever, because of the way they're looking, because
right,
of everything.
Right, right.
So I get to cheat a lot on that. And I think if you left me alone in an antique store, I would fail miserably every time.
That's hilarious.
So I think one of my as many people did, I started watching this show with my parents 20 years ago because they're really into like Appalachian frontier era furniture from like the early 1800s, late 1700s, stuff like that. And they used to watch it like fast forwarding through to get to those bits, which made me crazy. But that's a whole different story. And one of the things that my mom loves is when, and I think is fabulous, is when somebody finds something that's a fake that was made in an interesting period of time that's still incredibly old. So a lot of times people will have what were, you know, 80 year later reproductions of furniture that was made in the, you know, early 1800s, but that was made like the post Civil War, basically.
Well, there's that famous case of the sideboard in which they'd stripped off the original fake mahogany lacquer. It was on your show.
Well, that,
I seem
that's
to remember.
Good. Well,
it was an 18th century piece of furniture, if I remember correctly.
Adam, did you just on episode C31, part two?
It had this bad finish,
yeah.
Right? Like this dark lacquer over it, and they had removed the lacquer, and they were informed that the lacquer was original to exactly what you're talking
exactly.
about. It was supposed to be an imitation.
Was it lacquer or veneer? Probably a veneer. Yes,
it was a veneer
from 20 years earlier,
yes.
And that if they hadn't removed it, it would have been worth like over $100,000, and yes. Because they'd removed it, it was worth 20.
Yeah, that happened. A lot.
I mean, would imagine.
But there's an interesting distinction between a reproduction and a fake.
Right.
And a fake is made intentionally to deceive. And there's, and everybody should go out and look this. I can't tell this story nearly as well, but there's a fabulous story of this guy who made a 17th century armchair called the Brewster chair. I was reminded of this. I was trying to think of things to talk with Adam about. He was a maker, and he was also in the business, and he thought, I'm gonna see what happens, and he built this chair, and he did everything to the wood and the chair. He made it out of green wood, right? He didn't use properly dried wood, which is what would have happened back in the 1640s, 1660s. He used original tools, and he made this thing, and then he threw it in the sea, and he buried it, and he burnt it, and he did all sorts of things to make this thing really go through the aging process. And he stuck it in, you know, where he knew antique dealers were, you know, going past.
Fascinating.
And eventually somebody picked it up, and then eventually it ended up in a museum, and then eventually there was an argument, and I don't remember the full details, but he said, well, that's a fake. And they said, no, it's not. We know it's right, and so on and so forth. He said, no, I made it. And they said, no, you didn't. And he said, well, I tell you what, I used one modern tool in one part of this. And if you x-ray it here, you'll see this is, you know, shows the mark of a modern tool. And I think it was a spade bit or something like that.
Right.
Wow.
And sure enough, you know, he proved him. And I think there was a backstory of a sort of an axe to grind against certain people.
But, I remember this story. Yeah. I believe it was a long form article.
Yeah, a very long article. And it's a brilliant story.
Yeah.
But so that's a fake of a different, I mean, there's a brilliant construction. Most fakes are made to deceive, to try to get money off people. And there's a fabulous book called, I can't remember, his name was Perenyi. I was going to say Art of the Deal, but that wasn't it.
No.
Art of the Steal, possibly. But anyway,
it was a fake by Philip de Montebello about Elmir de Ory, the famous art forger, which is a lovely book.
But this guy Perenyi had started out faking Dutch masters, and then he moved into early American painting, and he said, you know, people bring these things down from their attic, and nobody has any provenance of those things. And he actually said, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that the amount of fake art in out there in the world is somewhere between 25% and 40%.
Wow.
They're running out of old masters.
Well, there's a museum in Texas devoted specifically to fakes of a couple of forgers. Yeah, and there's one whose goal was never to steal money. He would donate the sketches he would do that looked like Chagall's and other artists of the time.
So the act is the art.
Yeah, and he would show up in a Vickers call. The New Yorker did a long piece about him. And he donated hundreds of pieces to museums all across the U.S. And like one guy, he would never received any money for this. Yeah. So it's this weird non-crime, although...
Did he commit a crime?
I believe there is a statute that he's violating.
A misrepresentation.
But it took a long time to find him, and his pieces are in all of these American.
And there also happens to be a statute of limitations.
And there was always a bit of theater around it. He often did this in a Vickers collar and would have this long story about how my grandfather knew blah, 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 and anyway would like these to go somewhere.
It sounds dangerously close to performance art to me.
It does, like a little bit like J.S.G. Boggs and his dollars and his money.
Then you just put it through a shredder at the end and you make a fortune.
Only halfway. The shredder has to fail halfway through. Yeah.
So fake antiques is one of the significant plot devices from The Goldfinch. I don't know if you read Donna Tartt's book.
I'm halfway through. I'm afraid I haven't. I keep...
Love that book so much.
Okay. Isn't that the one they're turning into the movie?
I think they are. Yes, it's already cut. Michael Green told us that he'd seen a cut of it.
Yes.
But so what he talked about was you build something... His particular expertise was taking not valuable pieces of furniture from a time and combining them with others from the same time to make weird, like, unicorn hybrids that someone who knew enough about furniture would know that's something special. And what he'd do is he would turn the vacuum cleaner in reverse and just blow dust on it and then sit it in the corner of the shop where no one would notice it for months. And then when someone did, they would feel like they'd uncovered something, and he'd gently sell it to them for what they thought was a steal, but was in fact him stealing.
He sold them on the experience.
Yeah. Which is why one of the criteria that we value, perhaps most value in our appraisers, is integrity. And it's a great business, and there's some fabulous stuff, and you learn a lot about culture and so on and so forth. But there's also, a disproportionate number of people who are out there who might want to make more money than they were properly allowed out of whatever it is they're selling.
Within the ethos of the system itself.
Yes.
The thing my mom says is you always have to beware of a junk shop owner wearing a tie or an antique store. You know, in the South, the junk shops, the antique stores call it the same thing.
Yeah.
The level of quality of goods inside. And she said, if he's wearing a tie, you have to be really careful. That's always a worry. That's always a
I discovered touring around the country that the best thing to look for in each town is an antique mall.
Yes. Mm.
Those are fruitful locuses of lots of different things. In my experience,
you have to walk a long way in an antiques mall to find something good. Though
you
very
do,
often,
yeah. I'm usually looking for tools, which aren't very collectible. And I mean, I have a piece, a little folding ruler, a little folding Stanley ruler that a gentleman might keep in their pocket. And this one's silver plate and ivory. And I think I picked it up for $40 somewhere. You know, these tools aren't being looked at a lot,
and so unsaleable in California.
Oh, probably. Oh, right. Yeah. I have a couple. I have actually a piece of ivory my grandfather gave me in here. Oh, actually, this is a lovely piece. Hold on.
Headphones. He's going to ask for an appraisal. It's going to be very awkward.
Adam just went to the bookshelves. He's grabbing something.
He's opened a cabinet.
All right.
He's opened a can of worms. That's
yes.
Yeah, this is awkward for everyone now.
All right.
You got to get a painted word picture.
Tested.com does not endorse.
Okay, so what I'm holding in my hand is a what looks like a sort of a divan or lounge that's miniature, on which lies a woman carved in ivory. If you look closely at her face, she seems to be of Asian descent, at least from that side of the Pacific. and it, she's sitting on a inside a little plastic vitrine. Do you know what this is, Sam? Do you have an idea?
There are children present, Adam.
Oh, it's not that
bad. No. Do I know what this is?
You know, it was given to my grandfather by a grateful patient as a present. My grandfather was a surgeon, actually a fairly renowned surgeon in his time.
Well, as a representative of Antiques Roadshow, I'm probably going to demur. One of the things I know is that I frequently get these "what is it" things wrong.
Oh, well, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, but that's okay. But I have a suspicion that your glee around this is it's something more than just a curiosity.
It is, in fact, if you were a woman, it's what I understand is, I think this is Japanese, and if you were a woman who went to the doctor in the 19th century, you'd never be so untoward as to mention body parts or talk about your body. But if you had an ailment, this reclining figure and the way it's posed allows you to point to where it hurts without having to be so uncouth as to say the words.
I would suggest that that's a very nice story, but highly unlikely.
Is it really?
Adam
just got Antique Roadshowed.
This doesn't
live on the podcast.
I am not an expert. This doesn't look to me like anything other than a decorative object.
Oh, okay.
But I know exactly the person you need to talk to.
Fabulous. That's awesome. I would love to. If you give me the download, we'll post it in the comments here.
That's amazing.
I think there's no better place to end this than that. That was fabulous.
Sam, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming by, Sam.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Sam. See you soon. Come on back.
All right.